All right, good morning, everybody. This is March 6th already, and this is a morning work session. Good morning, and today's subject is cost recovery policy for the Portland Parks Bureau. I don't know, Commissioner, if you wanted to start us off.
I do. Thank you very much, Mayor. Thank you to both you and Commissioner Daly for being here. Commissioner Fish assured me he would watch the proceedings on video, so I'm grateful for that because we're here to review Portland Parks and Recreation's cost recovery policy and receive your input on potential revisions to the policy. It hasn't been changed since 2004, so it seems about the right time to have a look at it, and we're here early in the process to get Council's feedback. As you know, Portland Parks and Recreation is the city's largest non-public safety general fund bureau and is very dependent on fees for its services to cover costs, something like $25 million worth of fees that go into the budget of about $100 million. So you can see that it's a major proportion of what we're financed by. And in fact, two of the budget considerations that we'll be discussing this year are fee increases. We will be discussing that issue essentially all morning, how the council values access to different kinds of parks and recreation services, what types of services ought to have greater cost recovery in the new policy, what types of services are important to be accessible for everyone with less cost recovery and more general fund subsidy. So some of the examples of the fees that we have are for classes at community centres, picnic shelter and ball field rentals, private classes for music instruction, tree permits, many others, you name it. If we can, in the past, we have charged a fee for it. Fee increases have directly I'm going to read this particular paragraph because it's really important, so if everybody could pay special attention. Fee increases have a direct implication for access. As fees increase, services that might have been affordable for most families become less affordable. Over the past several years, the city has made great strides in recognizing the historic inequities in our community and addressing them with policies that reduce the barriers for Portlanders to access city services and programs. So this is what we're aiming to do with the revised cost recovery policy, to balance the council's commitment to inclusive services with the need for fiscal responsibility. So you may have seen the audit released by the city auditor last week on recreation scholarships, which illustrates the disconnect between council values and equity. And again, that's something that we'll be discussing in the budget process. So as we begin another year of difficult choices about which valued services to prioritize with greater general fund subsidy, the cost recovery policy discussion will provide direction to shape not only Portland Parks and Recreation's long-term financial plans, but also the city budget, and have a discussion about what does our community value and what are we willing to pay for it. Taxes and fees pay for services, and so basically this is about what services are we buying and who are we buying them for. What we will do in today's work session is, first of all, introduce and review the current cost recovery policy, identify the challenges with it, and then hear your guidance on the values and criteria that should inform efforts to update the existing policy. Over the next 6 months, then, we will involve the public and get their input, and then return in the fall with an updated cost recovery policy recommendation for the council's consideration. Any questions before we launch in? Director Mike Abate will kick off today's program.
Thanks, Commissioner. Mayor, Commissioner Udaly, Mike Abate, Director of Portland Parks. I'm joined today by Amy Archer-Masters, our Finance, Property, and Technology Manager, by Jason Smith, our Performance and Analysis Manager, and by Jamie Sabak, a Principal with 110% Consulting, who are experts, national experts, in cost recovery specifically related to parks. So as part of our effort to update our existing cost recovery policy and develop a financial plan, we reached out nationally and have hired 110% Consulting. Jamie's going to be sharing quite a bit of her experience with us today. So a few things we want to do today. We want to talk about the state of public parks and recreation, an overview of what we call cost recovery. And cost recovery just means that we're charging fees for a service. We're recovering a certain percentage of the cost of delivering those services. And then we'll give, as the Commissioner said, a brief overview of our existing policy. But most importantly, I think we want to have a conversation towards the end to seek your guidance and input towards developing an updated policy that helps us define criteria on how to allocate limited resources within different kinds of service categories. And then get your feedback also on our draft service area categories. You know, there's been a lot of talk about Portland Parks and Recreation and financial stability and financial stability plan. This is a key pillar to that. There's many efforts we'll be talking to you about this year, but this one, cost recovery, is a foundational building block. Charging for our services brings in needed revenue, but as the commissioner said, also has impact on who can access those services. So today we begin that conversation on how much we should charge and to whom. And with that, let's see, I'll talk about the timeline. This is really, we're coming to you early. We don't have a proposal to vet. It's a work session to bring you in at the very beginning stage of the project. That way we can take your thoughts and input and create a policy that aligns with those. We have a project steering committee, includes Parks Board representatives. We'll be working on this moving forward and creating a new financial model over the summer, and then we'll be back to you in the fall to look at an updated cost recovery policy for your consideration. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Jamie Sabak.
Ask a clarifying question, Mike. So this process concludes at the end of the budget set. So the budget's already pretty much locked in. So is this a policy that the council could adopt subsequent to the budget and prior to the next year?
Yes. Okay. Yes, great. It's really meant a 6-month process, not directly affected by the budget, although there are some things in the budget this year, scholarships and others that are related.
Yes, it's beginning a holistic conversation, and part of my goal before I stop being the commissioner in charge of Portland Parks and Recreation, whenever that might be, is to have a very clear plan for financial sustainability and a clear understanding of what are we going to work towards over the next 10 years or so and how are we going to pay for it.
That's excellent. Great. Thank you.
Oh, good morning. Try to burn this down since I'm so tall. Appreciate the opportunity to be with you this morning, and certainly appreciate the opportunity to work with the Bureau on this really important project. Let me give you a brief background on myself. I spent 20 years as a practitioner in public parks and recreation across the U.S., most recently with the city of Boulder, Colorado, and the last 10 years working with agencies across the U.S. and Canada on this very issue, cost recovery. How do we think about investing the resources we have, as well as how we creatively, innovatively, and responsibly think about generating revenues, translate cost recovery. We are seeing quite a few, I would argue, trends, not so much fads anymore, but this is a trend in terms of our profession, how we're beginning to, again, address the notion of cost recovery in the public sector. And within a system like a park and recreation system that tends to be one of the most complex in government, you've got everything from day camps and programs for teens and childcare, if you will, all the way through to services like golf courses that are expected to generate excess revenue. So it's quite a complex conversation, certainly. It's a complex system. And there are a lot of challenges with the notion that we are going to charge people for services that sometimes they believe their taxes cover, and we know that that's not necessarily the case. So we're kind of in a precarious place right now in terms of the public park and recreation world. The conversation we're having here is not unlike conversations happening all across the U.S. around cost recovery. I'd like to create a little context because I think it's quite helpful to the conversation. For those that may not know, Parks and Recreation was birthed many, many, many years ago with Boston Commons. We were really about public land management. And over time, we evolved into systems that included not only public parks, land management, trails, open spaces, but also systems that were expected to provide community centers, recreational activities, again, everything from day camps to really beautiful aquatics facilities that we now manage across the country. Post-World War II is when we started to see a shift from public park and land management to recreation services being provided in communities. And that was a time when our governments were able to subsidize those services fully. And we now know today, particularly as we saw a shift in a change in how we thought about government and government provision of service in the 80s and 90s, that we are now expected to provide high levels of service, yet we're challenged and strained in terms of how to think about how we're going to cover the costs of providing those services. So we've seen a bit of an evolution, which has positioned us to have high expectations of ourselves And at the same time, community expectations that we're going to, again, continue to provide high levels of service, knowing that we're challenged, again, finding the tax resources to be able to cover those costs. So we've had to start thinking creatively and thoughtfully about how we're going to recover the costs of providing services and the cost of doing business in public parks and recreation. It's amongst the services in our systems that has the ability to generate revenues. The next slide gives an overview of some of the most profound challenges that the public park and recreation world is experiencing right now. This is not only from my experiences in my consulting role, but also it's fodder right now at the National Recreation and Park Association level. That's our governing body, our national governing body for public park and recreation provision. We've got what we are calling extensive service portfolios or the herd approach to public park and recreation provision, meaning that if the neighboring community is providing that service, we've got to have it too. If the neighboring community is building a rec center, then we've got to have one too. If the neighboring community builds a mountain bike park, we've got to have one too. And what it's done is it's strained, obviously, our portfolio, and it's strained the resources that we have available to provide these services. We have increased expectations, not only of ourselves, but from our communities and our customers. We want services from Parks and Recreation. We need services from Parks and Recreation. We've always said it was a quality of life issue in our profession. And I don't think any of us could imagine our local communities without Park and Recreation services. It would really be a daunting proposition to say that we wouldn't have a place for our kids to go play or for us to go work out or whatever it might be. So our expectations are rather high. We've got more competition than ever before. We've got the private sector entertaining the idea of being in the health and wellness world, and they do it in a profit-making way. We've got the nonprofit world that's providing park and rec services, and then the expectation is the public sector will continue to do the same. So we've got a lot of overlap. And when we start thinking about it from the private sector perspective, it's really a challenge for the public sector to continue to compete with the private sector, knowing that we could be affecting the private sector's bottom line when they are indeed the ones contributing to the tax base. So we've got some really interesting, complex issues at our feet right now. We've got incredibly fickle markets. I think we can all appreciate that as consumers ourselves. We're not quite sure what we want. Sometimes we just want what people tell us what we want or what we want. There's a ton of market research out there to suggest that we've just got a very fickle market in the U.S. right now in terms of what kind of services do we want? What kind of services do we think we need? Significant development. There's, again, a lot of expectation around developing, but we also know that when we develop, and we may do it at the expense of our existing infrastructure, it breeds debt. And that's just a reality that we have to face. And it also prompts us to have some very difficult conversations about how we balance those two things. We used to say we had limited resources in government. Now we're starting to suggest that we have finite resources. The question becomes not so much can we get more, but how do we best invest what we have for the biggest bang for our buck, if you will. Arguably, some might suggest that we have uninformed constituencies, and that's certainly not a critique or a criticism. The suggestion is, have we done enough to let our constituents know what the realities are in government? What is it that we're facing? How do we best respond and react to our current realities? I like to think about it in terms of, do our policies reflect reality, or are our policies a bit antiquated? And I think in large part that's why we're here today, is to begin to think about the current policy as it exists, and does it connect with our reality today, and how do we update it, re-engineer it, and create a policy that really aligns with our realities.
Jamie, I have to jump in on this.
Please do.
This is my big issue. I don't think it's necessarily the case that the constituency is uninformed, but I think they're given the wrong set of choices from which to choose.
Very well be.
For example, we go out to our community loves our parks, and I would say on the whole they're very aware of what the options are, and on the whole they're aware of the finite resource question. But the question we put to them isn't, can you weigh the following 10 parks programs against public safety or road infrastructure or something else? We tend to be very prescribed and constrained in terms of the questions we ask, and we get the feedback we deserve during our budget process when what happens is everybody comes into the chamber and they say, we love all of our parks programs, don't cut our parks programs. And then some of the very same people will come in a meeting 2 months later and yell at us because there's a public safety issue that hasn't been addressed. but we've never really put them in a position of balancing those two competing interests, given that we have finite resources. And that's our job as the city council, to balance those two approaches. But I don't think we've ever really found the right formula to engage the public in helping us to weigh those difficult trade-offs that go beyond a particular interest area. That's my only comment, but it's what keeps me up at night.
Sure. Well, and again, we're thinking about this in terms of in the U.S. park and recreation world. So maybe in Portland, if we were to identify a key issue here, it would be how to better engage or how to improve our engagement efforts with our community members, our stakeholders. And then finally, we know that we've got a significant reliance on tax dollars. And with sometimes a rather volatile economy, an unpredictable economy, that positions us in a place of a lot of uncertainty. And it's just recognizing and acknowledging that moving forward, which is, again, what prompts us to have these conversations about cost recovery moving forward, particularly with the Bureau.
I like your cartoon.
Oh, thank you. Yes, if you didn't have a chance to look at that cartoon, it is quite funny. What we're seeing, again, through the National Recreation and Park Association is a national trend that's, I won't call it disturbing necessarily, but a bit provocative. And that is that we're seeing our expenditures in our profession going up at a rate of approximately 3%, while our revenue line's going up a little bit over 1%. And what that essentially is translating to is a continued gap as we move forward. Many organizations that have responded to the information that NRPA, the National Association, was looking for, did not include their capital in this as well. So we know that we've seen a decline across the country in terms of the amount of capital that's been invested into systems, you know, the dollars and cents that have to be invested in our infrastructure. Rather, we're seeing more money or a larger percentage of our budgets being put towards operations. So if we were to add this into the fold, it would be interesting to see how this graph would change. But my suspicion is that we'd see our expenditures go up at a higher rate and our revenues kind of flatlining. So what we're doing at the end of the day really across the U.S. relative to cost recovery conversations in public parks and recreation is beginning to challenge ourselves to think about how do we balance business principles, and not suggesting that we operate like a business, because folks will go to the dark side when they hear the B word in the public sector and say, well, we're not a business. But the suggestion is we adopt business principles. We think a little bit more business-minded in terms of how we manage our systems, with the end game being we're all about social purpose. It's how do we provide for the betterment of our communities, the community good, the common good, the social good of our communities. And rightly so, I think the what we're seeing in terms of trends and in terms of shift in how we do business in the public sector is that we are starting to adopt these models, but we haven't really driven home the fact that the reason we're doing that is in order to honor our principal focus, which is the community as a whole. It's how do we provide for social good. That's what the public sector stands on. It's one of our pillars. So this cost recovery policy update is grounded in adoption of business principles in order to honor our commitment to the social good and the social benefit of the greater Portland community. I'd like to give you just a quick overview of cost recovery philosophy as we have thought about it in public parks and recreation over the last three decades. I call it cost recovery philosophy of yesterday. And Jason, if you could just kind of go through these figures. Commissioners, you'll see on the next slide a menu, if you will, of different services that are provided through a typical park and recreation system, not unlike the city of Portland. So we have looked at parks as a portion of our menu, and the expectation is parks would bring in approximately 0 to 10% cost recovery. And for those who may not understand or aren't clear on what cost recovery is, what we're essentially saying is we're going to be recovering 0 to 10 cents on the dollar that we spend for parks. In youth sports, we've said that our baseline or our benchmark, rather, our professional benchmark as a profession was 50% cost recovery. For adult sports, it was 75%. For aquatics, it was 50%. For seniors or older adults, it was 25%. And so on the story went.
And this, just to clarify, is average in the industry. We're going to get in later as to what our cost recovery policy
is. Yes, this is the historic approach.
But just to clarify the top one on parks, that would be things like permits for renting space within parks.
Shelter, those kinds of things.
Well, and I'm going to clarify, it wouldn't necessarily be your rentals. It would be the provision of your general park areas, so the maintenance of the parks. It would be providing the parks. Rentals might be a different category.
No, but in terms of cost recovery, we don't generally charge people for maintenance.
correct. So this is how we've approached it. But we've found, and we've got very few educators, very few academicians who study public parks and recreation as part of their teaching in higher education, but the few that have done some interesting study, and they've determined that this has been a rather ineffective approach, because what we've done is we've created a benchmark for a profession with communities like Boulder, Colorado, and the city of Chicago being compared and contrasted against one another. And we know in Boulder our cost recovery is 91%, and the city of Chicago, the Chicago Park District, it's under 10%. So there is certainly a place and space for benchmarking, but when it came to cost recovery, this really wasn't one of them. So we found that this has been an ineffective approach to say that youth sports is going to be this, and youth adult sports is going to be this, and aquatics is going to be this. The other real challenging thing here is we start to pit special interests against one another, and I say special interests with the utmost respect. This is not a criticism of special interests, but if I have a child who's a T-baller, then I'm probably going to care a lot about T-ball. Or if I'm a mountain biker, I'm going to care a lot about mountain biking, but I'm not necessarily going to be as concerned about older adults or something else. So we started to see a gravitation towards special interests with this model. The next slide is an illustration of how we're beginning to think about the cost recovery conversation and the development of cost recovery in the public sector, and specifically a philosophy. And the philosophy, of course, translating to a model, the image of our cost recovery approach or our goals or whatever it might be. And we like to think about it as a three-legged stool. It oversimplifies, again, something rather complex, but we like to think about the development of cost recovery based on three elements, three pillars, three legs of a stool. One is the importance of creating service categories. The second is considering those service categories and their benefit to the community as a whole or to the individual. And third, it's what do these categories or what do these services cost the system? And it's not to just suggest that any one of these independent of one another is going to be the driver in terms of how we think about cost recovery. Rather, it's how we think about all of these together. And I'd like to give you an example of how this all rolls up. So if you look at or you think about the previous way we've approached cost recovery, right? We had youth sports, adult sports, seniors. We've pitted ourselves into these social values arguments and social values positioning conversations. So if I'm an older adult, I might think seniors are the greatest service we provide in the public sector, and we're going to direct a lot of our subsidy there. If I've got a child who's a T-baller, I might think that youth sports and Little League is the most important thing in the community because it contributes to the social, physiological, and emotional growth of children, whatever it might be. But if we can think about service categories, which takes us back seven decades in our profession and into the literature that said that we're not going to create categorizations based on special populations, rather we're going to create categorizations based upon likeness of service. So for example, Commissioner Fritz, if you had a five-year-old granddaughter who wanted to take ballet for the very first time in her life, and I had a five-year-old little boy who wanted to play T-ball, and your mom wanted to pick up guitar, and she's 75 years old and she'd never played the guitar before, in our past way of thinking about service areas or service units, it would be performing arts versus youth sports versus seniors in terms of how we wanted to subsidize those services. But if we can look through a different lens in terms of categorization and say, what do those things have in common? Well, they're all introductory level classes, courses, events, and activities. They're very baseline. Anyone can access those services regardless of skill or ability. And if we begin to categorize in that way in terms of likeness as opposed to based on population or something else that separates and creates a divide, it gives us a very different complexion and a very different lens into which we can think about cost recovery development. So that's the first leg of the stool is to begin to create service categories. And Jason, I believe, is going to be sharing some of the cost or the service categories with you a little bit later that are in progress for the Bureau. The second thing,
I'd like to comment on that, because sure. We have been, at least I have been very clear as Commissioner, we don't have an Olympic-sized pool in Portland Parks Recreation. We don't aspire to have a world-class mountain biking facility. We, in general, focus our attention and have on the beginner facilities. And so I really appreciate that categorization.
Good. Thank you. So once we've created the service categories, we want to define them so they're incredibly clear to everyone, and we want to put examples on them so that whomever the staff member is in the system, whomever the general public member is that looks at that says, okay, I understand. I understand what that means. We want to be as transparent as possible in the development of those categories. Once we've got the categories developed, then we want to begin to have a conversation, subjective as it is, about beneficiary of service. So if we were to look at those very services in that introductory, you know, beginner level category of courses, classes, events, and activities, we then want to ask the community, we want to ask our elected officials, and we want to ask our staff, you know, the content matter experts, boots on the ground, who are the beneficiaries of these services? Is it the community as a whole, or is it individuals in the community? And then finally, we want to identify cost of service. And I give kudos to this organization because many organizations across the U.S. have no idea what it costs them to do business. And Portland has spent quite a bit of time and energy in identifying costs of doing business. And I think they acknowledge that there are a few tweaks and adjustments they want to make to better identify costs of doing business. But you've got a great head start because most of the organizations in the U.S., they identify direct costs only, and they establish a cost recovery goal or expectation based on something that's not reality. So the Bureau is far ahead of many other organizations right now in the U.S. But once we have these three stool legs, if you will, addressed, and we've done some work in these areas, we can then begin to think about creating a model, a philosophy, if you will, around how we want to think about cost recovery and cost recovery expectation in our organizations. I'm going to take you to a different place here just for a brief moment. The illustration on the next page is one that we continue to call a tax use or revenue enhancement model. And for the sake of the hard copies, because all of the illustration is here, please recognize there's a little bit of animation that goes along with this. But the intention here is for us to begin to think about our systems a little bit differently than we have historically. And if you can just focus on the arrows for a moment, what it allows us to do is to break down our systems into a system that has a complex service menu. But the idea is that we recognize and understand that we have services in our system that must have subsidy in order to survive. We recognize and understand that the idea that we're going to be at full cost recovery for things like our public parks, that we're going to be at full cost recovery for things like services for low-income youth and families, where affordability, where an ability to pay is an issue as opposed to a willingness to pay is an issue. Those are services that demand subsidy. They need the subsidy in order to survive. On the contrary, we have services that, frankly, are available by other sectors. They're available in the nonprofit sector. They're available in the private sector. And we might begin to challenge ourselves whether or not we believe those services should require any subsidy. Full cost recovery is not a dirty word, as we like to say. It's just about recovering the cost of doing business. We're not talking about generating excess revenues. We're not talking about profit center at all. And then finally, we recognize that we do have certain services in our systems that may serve us well in terms of becoming profit centers or enterprise operations. But the caution here is that we're not in the profit-making business in the public sector. We recognize and understand that. But what this model does is it becomes one that allows us to illustrate how we can reallocate in our departments, in our systems, in the Bureau for the health of the entire system. And at the same time, we also have services that questionably we may believe we shouldn't continue. We may no longer want to be in the business or need to be in the business because these are accessible and available elsewhere. We sometimes, in our world, the general world of public parks and recreation, believe we have to provide something for everyone. And I think the fundamental reality for us is we are now taking a step back and saying, as long as it's available and accessible in the community, does it matter if our logo is on it or someone else's, as long as it's available and accessible in the community. So questionably, there may be some services that we identify that we say, you know what, if we divest of these services, we can take the staff time, the facility space, and the money and reinvest it elsewhere in our system. So this illustration gives you a sense of how we begin to think about the system as a whole and reinvestment or reallocation within the system to create a healthy system, but make sure we're sustaining our subsidized services, again, our public park spaces, our infrastructure, recognizing we have services that can be, maybe arguably should be, at full cost recovery, and that we have service opportunities that can generate excess revenues, again, for the health of the entire system. If we begin to kind of, we'll say, drill down even deeper, what you have on the next page is a model of what a cost recovery continuum begins to look like. It's an unveiling of sorts. So we've taken the two previous slides plus, of course, the intention behind the three-legged stool and the development of the service categories the beneficiary of service exercise, and then the cost of doing business, and we begin to see a continuum unveil itself and show its face. And you can see on the vertical axis, the expectation here is that that would be the representation of our cost recovery expectation or our subsidy allocation, depending on how you want to think about it. And then the horizontal axis from left to right would be more public benefit to the left and greater individual benefit or more private benefit to the right. And this is just an example of some service categories from another organization that have been placed on the continuum. Bottom left, again, being more public benefit and higher subsidy level, all the way to those services in the top right that are considered more individual in nature or more private benefit and would have a higher cost recovery expectation, or possibly the expectation would be that they would generate excess revenues, again, in order to reinvest in the system. So one of the things that we have as an advantage, and it's quite an advantage in public parks and recreation, is we have services that can generate minimally full cost recovery, if not excess revenue generation, with the full intention, again, of being reinvestment back into the system. We're not suggesting necessarily that the system be 100% cost recovery or more. What we're saying are there services that would allow us excess revenue generation to reinvest in the organization for low-income youth and family services, for programs for people with disabilities, whatever it might be. So this, again, is just one example. And this is the path that we're headed down right now in terms of thinking about service categorization for the Bureau, definitions of those service categories, how we want to begin to think about cost recovery for the Bureau, and how we'd like to see the definitions of public service and private benefit or private benefit to the individual be defined for Portland, because this is not a one-size-fits-all approach. The framework is similar, but the approach, the definitions, the categories are all unique and independent to the organization.
And is the intention that at the end of this process we'll have our Portland cost recovery continuum, and in fact that council discussion today and moving forward will decide, do we agree that rentals are further up that way than community events?
Right. And we'd like to get community input as well as the staff's input. Kind of that, you know, it's a tentacle approach. We want the staff, who obviously boots on the ground. We need the elected officials who represent the community. And then, of course, if we can get community representatives to be part of the conversation, it certainly will help.
We have a great parks board, too. I'm sure we'll be involved in this. I just wanted to highlight this because, and we'll come back to it and discuss it again before the end of the session.
I'll just pause. Are there any questions over what Jamie just reviewed, kind of the national overview of the issues related to cost recovery? No? Okay. Well, then let me move on to kind of kick off a discussion of where we are. Where's Portland in this continuum? We do have an existing cost recovery policy. It was brought to council in 2004. I think Commissioner Saltzman is the only commissioner that was involved at the time. The policy directs the Bureau to achieve certain specific cost recovery goals, and it's been a guide to us to helping us set prices since 2004. And that's why we're here today, is to talk through the next iteration of that cost recovery policy, because a lot has changed in those 20 years or so, almost 24 or 8. Do the math for me. What is that? 14 years. Thank you. Long time. The city has grown by 100,000 people. Our population is way more diverse, and though the economy is strong, we still have economic inequities in the society, and local poverty is still a problem. We now have a 5-year racial equity plan in place, and council's made that a priority through the development of the Office of Equity and Human Rights. I mentioned Commissioner Saltzman, and with a changed environment, changed economy, many new council members, this is the key thing to have a conversation with you today. So I'm going to turn it over to Jason to kind of walk through our existing current cost recovery policy.
So we do, as Mike said, we have a current policy from 2004. Our current policy is actually a pretty complicated formula that we use to achieve overall goals approved by council in 2004. It actually went to council in the form of a resolution. So PPNR's current cost recovery policy is focused on basically two dimensions. We're talking about age, and we're talking about neighborhood income from which the services are delivered. So services focused on youth are expected to have a lower cost recovery rate
compared to services focused on adults, where we try to achieve a higher cost recovery rate. Also, services provided in low-income neighborhoods are expected to have a lower cost recovery rate compared to higher-income neighborhoods. And let me give you a little example of that. So if you look at a community center like Southwest Community Center, which is in generally a higher-income neighborhood, you'll observe a much higher price structure than if you looked at a site in, for example, when we did our policy in 2004, at the time, University Park Community Center, now Charles Jordan Community Center, had a very low price structure and still has a very low price structure compared to Southwest Community Center. And again, that reflects the guidance in our policy.
Reflects the geographic area, regardless of whether a particular individual is high income or low income.
Great point.
Which, again, we've been trying to address with the scholarship policy and have not been able to do so far. But that's, I think, a really important point on the current policy.
Right. So we have these specific targets depending on, you know, your age group and your neighborhood income, and then our overall combined target for the organization is a 39% total cost recovery rate. So I want to talk a little bit about the details of how we actually measure cost recovery. Cost recovery is really about how much of our budget is supported by taxes, as Jamie has noted, or general fund dollars versus fees and outside dollars. So a cost recovery policy helps guide what mix of resources ought to be. To understand where we are, we actually complete a cost of service analysis every 2 years. This is consistent with city financial policies, which identifies bureaus that have fee-supported programs to do a cost recovery analysis. We break out our costs into a couple different buckets. So the chart in front of you, the two bars, one's blue shaded and one's green. On the blue, you'll see is our expense side, and we break out what we call direct costs, which is really the staff and material costs of providing a program or a service. It's really important that, as Jamie noted, that we're looking at the total cost involved with providing the service, which is actually different from budget. And in this case, we're pulling in information around utilities, our maintenance costs, our overhead costs that support the service, and also we have a placeholder for capital replacement that we want to make sure we call out. That's the full cost of providing the service. You compare that to revenue, which in our case, revenue is divided into tax dollars from the general fund, and also outside revenue, non-tax revenue, as Jamie pointed out, in our case, which is mostly generated from fees, mostly at our community centers. But there's other instances of fees as well, like for our permits in our parks and picnic shelters, things like that. We also have a small amount of revenue, non-general fund, that comes in for concessions. And to a much smaller degree, we do get some grants and donations that support some of our programming. So basically, when you look at the chart, the portion of the total cost supported by the non-tax revenue is what we define as the Bureau's total cost recovery rate. So I want to talk a little bit how we've been trending over the past 10 years. In 2004, when we brought the last policy to City Council, we started with a 29% cost recovery rate. The latest data we have on this that we've pulled together is from 2016, and our cost recovery rate was 36% in 2016. The next slide shows you a little more detail about the year-over-year changes. So over time, the Bureau has increased its cost recovery rate. This has resulted partly due to increasing fees over the years in order to backfill general fund reductions. I think that's really important to point out. In fact, we've actually exceeded the 39% goal that I called out in 2013 and 2014 by achieving a 40% cost recovery rate before dropping down to 36% in 2016. I think it's important to note that even though our cost recovery rate has dropped, our revenue has increased substantially. And so when you look at our revenue over the past 14 years, you see an annual 9.1% increase in the revenue that we've been generating at parks. So the decline in recent years is really an expense side issue that's going on, and it's related to getting more general fund support for a couple things. The teen programming ad package that we got a few years ago, and to a larger degree, the recreation arbitration labor agreement, which brought in about a little over $4 million annually, to support family wage jobs and more full-time employment for our employees. So that's an important distinction to call out. And when you see this cost recovery rate trending down, it's not because we're lowering fees or because we're providing more access to low-income populations. It's really those two changes that have increased our general fund support.
And the council will remember with the preschool issue that preschool used to be complete cost recovery. Once we started paying the employees $15 an hour, then that was when we developed a fairly large hole.
So I'm going to turn it back to Mike now to talk a little bit about our the challenges that we're facing with the current policy that we have.
Yeah, thanks, Jason. And I think the preschool example is a really good one because we, you know, at direction from council last year, bring preschool in at 100% cost recovery, and so we've raised our fees up to nearly 50% in order to see if that's if enough people will sign up. So we're in the middle of a sort of an experiment on cost recovery specific to our preschools.
But even with that, we had to, well, I chose to put in an $80,000 request for scholarships because if we've gotten to full cost recovery, we don't think the program would survive at all. And so that's the essence of what we're discussing here today. Which services should the city be providing because nobody else is? As you said, you know, we don't necessarily need to compete. But then how do we make them affordable to the people who most need them?
And that's our biggest challenge, affordability. Like Jason said, we've offset some general fund reductions by increasing fees, and so our we're hearing it. We've done surveys. We're hearing from focus groups that our fees have become a burden and a barrier for some people who would like to take an entry level ballet class or dance class or youth sports program. That's the biggest challenge that we have. The table that you are looking at identifies the prices related to some of the most popular services that we've offered and how they've changed since the year 2000. So you can see annual pass at Charles Jordan and full service community centers comparing 2000 to 18, and you can see what the percent increase has been, 209%, for example, at Charles Jordan. As you can see, our prices have, in many cases, exceeded the rate of inflation. And that's important because as Portland families struggle to keep pace with cost of essential items such as housing and transportation and food, our public recreation opportunities are becoming unaffordable as well. About 4 years ago, we worked with Portland State to complete a series of focus groups with the Portland Latino community. One of the important things that we heard from those folks was that the cost of our programs were often too expensive. In particular, participants with children noted that when costs are multiplied for all children in a family, it becomes very much unaffordable. I mentioned the big survey that we did this year, a large random sample survey, statistically correct of the Portland community. I think we had 2009 respondents. When asked about barriers to participation, cost was identified as a barrier for 22% of the people who took that survey. So when we consider the demographics of survey respondents, we found that cost is a barrier disproportionately that's falling on people of color and low-income populations.
I would just point out when 22%, when we last did that same question in 2008, similar survey, same question, only 8% of the public identified costs as a barrier. So that's just more evidence that we're really seeing it over time.
I think we've done that slide, right?
Yeah,
examples of fee increases. Okay. Moving on to existing policy challenges, the growth in scholarships. So this is another sort of byproduct of this cost recovery. As we've increased fees, our requests for scholarships have grown. And remember that for us right now, our scholarships are really not a thing that are funded. It is deferred income. So we discount and we don't collect income, and that's scholarships. And that's, I think, at the heart of the auditor's report last week about our scholarship program. As I mentioned, over the years, as cost recovery has increased, the bureaus absorb this new financial burden. And you can see in that graph by year, it doesn't show up too well on the screen, but in the handout, you can see what we've been getting in terms of requests, starting from a low of $256,000 to a high of nearly $650,000. And those two things are coming in conflict. How do we achieve a cost recovery level of 39% while at the same time granting scholarships to people or discounting or offering free services?
And the other inequity with that is that it's not clear that you can get a scholarship. So if you know, if you have the courage to ask, you might be able to get one. It's not the same across the system. But more particularly, it's basically if there's space, you get in. Whereas for the people who are most challenged, we want them to have the first opportunity to choose the times and things that they most need and want to do, rather than being, if there's something left over, you can have it.
Mr. Mayor, you hit on our second policy challenge, which is the disconnection between this idea of cost recovery and the budget. That's why, though we're in a budget season right now, we're talking about a long-range strategy that would affect next year's budget and try to bring these two things together. That 14 years of age gives us an opportunity to link in, and so that our budget next year won't be narrowly focused on, you know, individual pieces, but will be part of a financial stability plan that includes cost recovery woven into it. The third challenge is that when this was created in 2004, we offered certain services. There are many things that we offer now that are not included in the cost recovery policy. You can see some examples, one of which is actually a couple of which are in the budget this year. So parking fees at parks as another revenue stream, urban forestry permitting fees. We have packages on both of those two in our in this year's budget, but also things like merchandise sales and general access to parks. We don't currently have anything in our cost recovery policy that would allow us to create some sort of fee basis for access to parks.
What do you mean by that?
That means some sort of cost in return for using various facilities and parks. So right now, I wouldn't advocate that we would go to like a neighborhood park and charge for the use. Okay. I don't advocate for that. But there may be cases where we have specific parks that are having an event or something like that that we might want to incorporate. But, yeah. Okay, I'm going to stop right there. And just, are there questions about the way we currently do things or have been doing things over the years, maybe scholarships or?
Do we currently charge for parking?
We charge for parking in two places. We charge for parking at Washington Park. Council made a decision to invest that money back into the park. We also have a little bit of parking at Willamette Park.
At Willamette. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Jamie, I'm going to turn it back over to you.
Okay, so what we were hoping to do for the remainder of our time with you this morning was engage in a dialogue, a conversation, get your feedback, perspectives, and opinions on a couple of questions to help kind of move our agenda forward with the development of a continuum. And in particular, we're looking for your thoughts concerning the values-based conversation, some help in terms of developing the criteria for the continuum as we're still in the early stages of the process. And then I'm going to pass it over to Jason at the end of our conversation to share with you the service categorizations that have been developed thus far, the first draft, the first iteration, if you will. Just to revisit the continuum in our next slide, to give you, again, another illustrative glimpse of what a continuum could look like, might look like for Portland. Recognizing again that what we're going to be attempting to do is craft some relevant service categories that represent the entire service menu of the Bureau, and then also begin to think about the beneficiary of service of all of those categories. Public benefit versus private benefit, or I will say rather public benefit and private benefit as opposed to a versus. We don't want to position one against the other. And we just recognize that some of our services benefit the community as a whole, maybe more so than an individual or vice versa. So the first question on the floor for commissioners this morning is on the next slide. And we're interested in your thoughts concerning what you believe the characteristics of a service that would benefit an individual more so than the community might be. So again, what would be the characteristics of a service that would be considered one that benefits an individual and not the community as a whole? And we thought we could entertain that question and throw it out in the middle of the table and on the floor for your thoughts and perspectives. It's not an easy one, certainly, but again, we want to be very diligent in making sure that our model and our philosophy reflects that of Portland and not necessarily any other community, and we want to avoid having some generic definition or description of what community benefit and private or individual benefit is. So not an easy question, certainly, but again, as representatives of the community as a whole, we think your perspectives are incredibly important to the conversation.
Go now?
Okay. Sure.
First of all, I want to apologize for keeping everyone waiting. I'm dealing with a neck and shoulder injury that is making it a little challenging for me to be upright right now. So I'm very sorry about that. Well, it's no secret to anyone that knows me that I'm not a big fan of golf. And I think our golf courses are... Sorry, Mayor, if that's your favorite.
Oh, no,
yeah. Oh, good. Okay. I like you even more now. I think that's an example of an aspect of parks that, in my mind, it's an extraordinary amount of space and resources to serve a declining usership. And I know I've had a conversation with Commissioner Fritz. There's one golf course in particular, though, that's really popular with the community and the
Colwood.
Center, the Colwood.
Yeah, yeah.
That's great, but we have, I don't know how many more. So that would be an example for me that of something we're investing a lot of resources in to benefit very few people. Maybe we turn them into silent disco parks. I don't know. I won't tell you what I really want to do with the golf courses. It's too controversial. So that's okay. That's mine.
So is it because it's... bigger than golf, if we were to try to take that sort of principle, is it because it's a focused activity that relatively few people spend time in and specialize in? Is it, you know, trying to find parallels in other, using those kind of criteria so that we can think about, okay, that might also apply over in this,
sure.
This kinds of program, too.
I mean, I think that's a fair characterization, and I think we also have to look into the future, and just like millennials are ruining, I don't know, Applebee's and the real estate market, they're not playing golf, by and large. So why would we continue to invest in golf courses when there are a variety of other uses and activities that are more popular?
Commissioner, may I ask for a little bit more clarification or maybe an add-on?
Sure.
So I heard you say an extraordinary amount of space and resources for a declining interest area.
Yeah.
Significant resource investment for a few
relative
folks,
few, yeah.
In comparison with the larger population. Are there any other things, you use golf as the example, are there other things about that particular activity that help us understand the characteristics about that activity that challenge you to believe that it requires or should get tax resources? Because we're really focusing on the characteristics of the kinds of services that you see as more individual in nature,
mm-hmm.
more private benefit.
I mean, it requires a certain amount of personal resources just to participate.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe an access issue?
Yeah. A Frisbee's $3. I don't know how much a set of golf clubs are, but I'd say I'm assuming that it's cost prohibitive to a lot of people. That really isn't my main argument. My main argument is just it doesn't seem like there is enough interest to achieve cost recovery.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I also have environmental concerns. Mm-hmm. There's the amount of, you know, water and pesticides and maintenance that have to
go
into
environmental impacts.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll throw one out there just for the sake of comparison. Bike polo. So we have bike polo is thriving in Portland. Now, thriving means a very small group of people, but I'm using that just as a kind of an example of, boy, that's a very focused, small group of people, very passionate. We have converted one tennis court to a bike polo court, and they've paid for it, and they'd be willing to do more. But it's that challenge of, well, that's a very narrow demographic that is playing bike polo, right? And so right now, they pay relatively little to pay to play.
Can that bike polo course be used for any other purpose?
No.
While it's not?
No.
Yeah, I mean,
it was an out-of-commission tennis court that wasn't getting used.
I see, so, yeah. I mean, I think that's another consideration is golf courses really aren't used for, I mean, I suppose you could take a stroll through a golf course, but not a flexible use space, which I would be more of a fan of. Now, miniature golf, that's a whole other story for me. I'd love it.
We could make some serious money on mini golf. Yeah.
Well, we're not on this question, but I am interested in merchandising revenue. I feel like we're under utilizing that possibility, not just at parks, just...
Yeah, I'll jump in on that because I agree. If you can eat it, drink it, wear it, or park it, I see those as mostly private benefit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Can you say that again?
Eat it, drink it, wear it, park it.
Yeah. Like on that continuum, we have merchandise for resale, food and beverage, all of that. Very high individual benefit and should have very low subsidy. If not a profit center. Yeah. Wear it.
Wear it.
Drink it.
Eat it, drink it, wear it, park it.
It's our new slogan.
There we go.
Cost recovery
costs.
What other thoughts do you have?
T-shirts made with that.
Nothing intelligent at the moment, but when I think of something, I'll let you know.
Because we're still on this question. Characteristics of a service that would be considered one that benefits an individual, not the community. I guess the activities that are high cost of entry or participation and relative low users, number of users.
What do you think? Commissioner mentioned that, you know, typically, we focus on the beginner and the intermediate, whatever that is, an art class or a sports league. Where does that make you go? Do you think, you know, facilities that might be for super more accomplished or, you know, advanced or even expert is something that would be something in the realm of, well, if you did that, you'd want it to be at the low end of subsidy, the high end of cost recovery? I don't know, just... Through thinking through how we categorize.
I agree with your current philosophy, which is access and a focus on entry-level opportunity. The goal here is to pull people out of their houses, away from the TV, get people active and engaged with each other in a meaningful way. And if somebody shows a real aptitude for a sport or an activity, there are plenty of private sector options if they really want to commit to that. That's not to say there will not be exceptions. As soon as I say that, I'm sure somebody's going to say, well, you know, there will be exceptions to that. So, but I would say, generally speaking, I think your philosophy is the right one.
Okay.
So I appreciate Commissioner Udaly bringing up the environmental aspects, and I think in line with our climate action plan and other sustainability principles, that's something that should be factoring into what we subsidize more versus less. I was thinking of individual things versus community things. Swimming comes to mind, where certainly an individual swimming lesson is of benefit primarily to the person learning to swim. On the other hand, we had the tragedies at Kelly Point Park, which were community tragedies. And where there's a disparity in who can swim and who cannot swim, I think that then becomes push it into the public benefit type thing. So that makes it challenging. And I was thinking of level of exercise, you know, because certainly health is something that I'm interested in promoting at Portland Parks and Recreation. And while some people are more able to do exercises than others, and for some just doing a very small amount of exercise is very challenging. For others, you know, we kind of want the more healthier things to be more subsidized, at least I do. And then I was thinking also that, you know, we kind of categorize many of the programs we do, many of them are exercise and many of them are arts programs. Mm-hmm. And so I don't, at this point,